The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, a very good morning. You're very welcome along to the 9 till noon show here in Highland Radio. It's 3 minutes past nine, Friday, the 3rd of February, and we welcome you to the programme. Now, how do you contact us and get involved in the conversation as our Friday panel joins us? Well, you can text or WhatsApp 086 60 25000, that's 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 07491 25000. If you wish to email, it's comments at highlandradio.com. And, you know, we still get the odd letter. They're more than welcome. The 9 till noon show, Highland Radio, Mountain Top, Letterkenny. And of course, as always, you can watch the programme on our website, highlandradio.com, or on YouTube or Facebook. Coming up a little later on, we have Seamus Gunn. He'll be joining us to answer your legal questions. So if you have any questions for Seamus, get them into us. On the numbers that I've just mentioned, and then obviously after 11 o'clock, it's Friday, so that's Michael and Fionnuala joining us for That's Entertainment. All right, okay. We are initially going to be joined by our guests on the telephone line. They'll rejoin us on Zoom a little later on. But firstly, we say good morning to Richard Logue, Project Manager in Transport London. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. How are you?
It's good. I'm good. It's good to have you with us. How are you keeping?
Yeah, pretty busy, and looking forward to some potential developments coming down the line for Donegal in coming weeks, as soon as we can hear anything on this All-Ireland Rail review.
Yeah.
So, feeling pretty optimistic.
Yeah, the direction of traffic, let me put it like that, seems to be moving in the right direction in terms of a rail link.
Well, certainly the mood music coming from Eamon Ryan and what we know so far, which has been effectively leaked from the All-Ireland Rail Review, sounds promising. Obviously, the Ulster man in me says, show me the evidence. So we'll have to see what comes out. But definitely, I'm feeling probably more optimistic now than I ever have been about possible revolution in transport for Donegal, which would be something else, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, but back to the future, or future to back to history, I don't know how you might describe it, but anyway, we'll talk about that a little later on, I would say. I want to say good morning to Dr. Peter O'Rourke, former consultant orthopaedic surgeon. Good morning to you, Peter.
Good morning, how are you?
I am good, thank you so much for joining us. And last but not least, Laura McMonagall, the editor of the Donegal newspaper. How are you keeping, Laura? Great to have you on the 9 till noon show.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Good, good, good. Thank you so much, all of you, for joining us. Okay. Right. We need to start, I suppose, with a story that's dominating the conversation, certainly out in the streets, if not on the media all the time. And it is that increase in protests across the country at the establishment of accommodation for migrants. The government says even with consultation, it wouldn't prevent many of these protests taking place. And they're insisting that they must continue to meet their international obligations. We hear Roderick O'Gorman is seeking more accommodation right around the country. And there's various elements to these protests, but many of them are locals who are concerned of the impact of the influx of new people. There seems to be a particular concern of men, what it might have, the impact it might have on their communities. I'll start with you, Peter. I can't presume, do you understand people's concerns? What do you think's going on, and where do you think it will all end?
I think when the numbers involved were so high, it was predictable there would be some reaction, but I've no idea where it'll end. Unfortunately, our asylum seeking program, our seekers program, has taken so long for people to actually get processed to get a positive or negative result in their appeal. It means that there's a large backlog, and that's just increasing. I think the Ukrainian situation is slightly different, because I'm quite sure the majority of the Ukrainians will want to return home as soon as it is safe to do so. But the fact that there's such a large volume of people coming into the country and putting a strain on resources, and also putting I suppose a strain on every resource, be it hospitals, schools and everything else, was bound to get some reaction. So it's not surprising, but it is unfortunate.
And how do you think things will play out?
I would imagine there will be more protests as there are increasing numbers of people coming into the country, unfortunately. I think when the Ukrainian war ends and a vast majority of the refugees go home, I think the pressure on services will ease. But in the short term, I think there will probably be more reaction from people in different parts of the country who feel that their needs haven't been looked after and there's preferential treatment for refugees, which is not really true, but it will be, a proposition put forward by a lot of people who want to create trouble and cause protest.
But there is obviously, this is going to feed into, Peter, a sense that the government is failing in its obligation to the people in terms of health provision, in terms of housing, and then they see people coming in. There is concerns about, people's backgrounds and what have you. And I think maybe when people see how their lives are going and they see how others are being treated and how much money's been spent in that area, you know, I think that is what is creating these very, in their minds, genuine concerns.
Yes, I agree with you totally. I mean, if you're struggling and then you see your government putting vast resources into people from another country, it is obviously going to not sit well with a lot of people and feel that the government should be looking after them rather than looking after people from another country. And that's what is going to allow people who have an agenda to try and cause trouble to actually increase the support they get.
Okay, Laura McMonagall, editor of the Donegal newspaper, good morning to you again. What do you think of what's going on?
Well, I think some of the images that we've seen at some of the protests have been very concerning. I was reading the piece in the Irish Times this morning about Minister O'Gorman writing to all ministers and asking for help in finding the likes of sports centres and large buildings to house refugees and, you know, sleeping bags and mattresses. And I think, obviously, there's a problem. Like, we need the government to act on this. There's genuine concern out there, and this concern needs to be directed at the government. It's their policy. I know they were saying that it's not their policy not to have consultation with community, but I think there has to be maybe more consultation with local communities to have a chat and say, look, what supports are needed for refugees and what can we do to help?
You see, the problem is it not, Laura, that the government know fine rightly, and that's why they abandoned the, you might remember when there was talk of a direct provision centre in Mobile, at around about that time, they abandoned the consultation process because people were coming into a room and making very strong arguments about their lack of access to GPs, problems at the hospital, issues with child care places, issues with places in schools. And there's no answer to that, really. There's no argument that government or their representatives can win in that regard. So that's why I think, to some extent, that's why they've jacked in the consultation element of it. I don't think there would be any, or there'd be very few direct provision centres or accommodation centres if consultation was undertaken properly.
Yeah, there's no doubt that services are being stretched and Ireland's capacity to deal with this is being stretched. We need to have a situation where the government really need to look at their policy overall. Like, Ireland has led the way as one of the first countries to welcome people, and I think we can do our part, but we have to remember that we are a small country and resources aren't endless. Also, other international countries have to play their part as well, just as Ireland has. I think it's good to remember as well that, look, there's a lot of goodwill out there. Just yesterday there was a coffee morning in Falkara, they had a welcome morning for Ukrainian refugees. So there are a lot of good stories out there that we need to remember about. But a lot of this has played out on social media as well, where there is no doubt there's a lot of anger there. But again, I think the genuine concerns of people need to be directed at the government.
Yeah, and to some extent then, if you're outside one of these buildings and there are people inside it, they're almost scapegoats. In other words, that really, I'm not saying people should go outside the elected politicians' houses, of course, but the place to protest then is where these decisions are being taken.
Well, exactly, where the decisions are being made, definitely.
Yeah, okay. Richard Logue, what do you think?
Okay, I think the whole issue actually is a real indictment of the state's failure to do proper planning over the last 40-50 years, because the fact that we've gone to the direct provision model for housing asylum seekers when other countries have been able to absorb them into social housing, even temporarily, just goes to show that we have ended up basically having to deal with almost sticking plaster solutions to a lot of these problems. Now, obviously, with the influx of Ukrainian refugees, and we rightly welcome them, you know, because of the trials and tribulations they've had because of the war through no fault of their own, you know, it has stretched the already fairly meagre provisions. And also, I have two concerns, I suppose. The first concern is that the there are elements within the far right in Ireland who are looking to exploit people's natural concerns about people getting, you know, provision for things like medical cards and all of that. And I think they're using it as a platform. I was reading also in the Irish Times this morning that there was a protest in Mullingar, which a lot of people came up from Dublin to take part in, which strikes me as something being organised on a fairly serious basis rather than a supposed ad hoc protest by locals. But the real issue is that the direct provision model is really flawed in the first place. And I think in 25, 30 years, it's going to be seen as our Magdalene laundries. And, you know, the root cause of the issues that people have are two things, I think. One is that we have a very poor access to free healthcare in this country. It's entirely means tested around the medical card. That model is really flawed. And then we also have, as I said, inadequate planning. So we end up in a situation where people are having to go on to camp beds and things like that. Now, when I talk about planning, I'm talking about 20, 30 years ahead. I'm not talking about trying to sort of scramble around now and do everything at the last minute. But as I say, I think there are elements out there who are using people's natural unhappiness about access to things like housing and medical care, and they're harnessing it for the, you know, for what I consider not to be very honourable reasons.
Okay, but maybe they are in some cases, and I don't think it was the case necessarily in Mullingar from the reports I've read, maybe in some cases there are elements that will latch on to this for their own means or to maybe, you know, direct it down their own agenda, dependent on who's watching their streams or not. But that doesn't take away from the fact that there are a lot of women, a lot of women with children and their partners or not, who are going out, you know, and their concerns are for the safety of their children. And it is not about Ukrainian women and children for the most part. It is, and, you know, we might as well have the conversation out in front here. It's not those that we're talking about here. They're concerned about large groups of males being bussed in to different parts of the country, and they're even being given no reassurance of, you know, their backgrounds or anything along those lines.
Yeah, there certainly are there are concerns, but I think that the elements that are actually organising these protests, I don't believe for one minute that they're actually doing it for honourable reasons. I think there is a huge element of racism. We can't forget that we as Irish people were a migrant race ourselves for for over 100 years since the famine. And we faced all sorts of terrible problems when we went to England, when we went to America back in the past. And, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, we are now a fairly wealthy country, thank God, and we have somewhat of a labour shortage. People are looking for jobs. But in terms of the asylum seekers side of things, mm-hmm. we're still under an obligation to our international obligations to actually accept, you know, a number of people.
All right.
Proportionately, we're not accepting any more than most.
Yep, right. Richard, stay where you are. We are going to take a quick break, and hopefully we'll be able to get you, Richard, logged in now on Zoom. The technical issues have been resolved. We'll be rejoined again by Peter, Laura and Richard after we take this break. All right, you're welcome back to the 9 till noon show. We're going to stay on this issue for just a short while. Laura, in terms of, you mentioned, you know, a positive thing in terms of that coffee morning that took place in Falkara, I think you mentioned recently. And you know, if that's posted or put in a paper, people, you know, it gets a certain amount of traction. But I did note one post from an individual who talked about the interaction between a local woman and seemingly, you know, someone who's moved to this country really recently, and it exploded onto social media. And, you know, I'm not questioning the person's motivations, whatever. I'm just saying it's a fact. It got shared all over the place, tons of comments, and an awful lot of fear There's an awful lot of people that are genuinely fearful. Now, whether that's right or wrong is a whole other debate or not, but it is something that the government cannot ignore any longer, I don't think.
Yeah, I think, as I said, a lot of this is playing out on social media. And look, there's no filters on social media. Obviously, like, the media have a role to play in this and to be responsible. But on social media, there's no filter. People do have concerns, but maybe it's easier to, you know, be a keyboard warrior online. As Richard had mentioned, there was people coming up from Dublin to attend that protest in Westmeath. So we would have to look at, in that terms, was there a lot of local, there obviously was a lot of local concern there. But as I mentioned, I think that concern needs to be directed at the policymakers rather than, you know, the people that are staying in these situations.
And Peter, what do you think the government can do in this regard? I mean, obviously, they will reference our international obligation, but it's also been noted that right across Europe, this is not an Irish problem, that right across Europe, there are similar concerns and protests taking place, and European leaders are saying, look, we have our role to play in this. But at the end of the day, I think you can't ignore a growing voice from the people forever either. You know, I do think that's what's coming down the line for various governments.
Well, I think part of the problem has started with the Good Friday Agreement, where we almost had an open border policy. I mean, I think we do have an obligation to look after refugees, but in a structured way. I mean, if we are taking Syrian refugees who are flown in after being vetted and brought into the country, or from Afghanistan and places like that, I think that's perfectly reasonable. But unfortunately, anybody who lands in Dublin Airport from a plane from anywhere can claim refugee asylum, whereas that is not directly in the rules. They're meant to claim asylum in the country in which they first land outside their whatever country they've left. So if we actually, I think, adhered to the policies and actually had a firm policy and allowed people who did seek refugee status to be processed quickly within a matter of days or weeks and either given the status or returned to wherever they came from, that would help. The problem is that you constantly in the media have situations where people arrive, claims status that they're not necessarily entitled to, and because the regulations are so loose that then people feel that anybody can come to Ireland and stay here, and that feeds into the right-wing agenda of trying to say there's a big problem. So I think if we had a robust refugee policy like other countries such as Australia or America, then people wouldn't be able to argue against it.
I'm not sure we can make our own policies, though, therein maybe to some extent lies the problem. Australia can do whatever they like. Richard, too, like, I understand where everyone's coming from in their statements, but I just personally want to differentiate from what I see in that, you know, I see communities with very genuine concerns, right? Probably because they're not being told, they're not given any information, they're not being told how this system works, how long people might be there. They're not told that people are coming, they come in the middle of the night. And I want to separate that out personally from my perspective, and it's up to everyone else what they do. I want to separate that out from some elements, some small elements, a lot of them high profile, that are latching themselves onto these local residents' concerns and then saying it's also because of this, that and the other. Because I think there are different camps there, and I think grouping everyone in's, from my perspective, I'm not saying that's what's being done here, but I don't think that's helpful either, Richard, because I know there's people listening, they will be listening going, oh, I don't even know what far right is, I'm just worried about this.
I think the issue is as well is it's actually taking the state far longer to process asylum applications, and as Peter rightly says, the whole issue is that somebody arrives in Ireland and claims asylum. Part of the issue of people being in direct provision is that it's actually, they've had their initial application rejected and then they're going through the appeals process. Now, I think we really need to put more resources into actually processing the appeals process so when we can weed out the sort of people. And we have a big problem here in England, by the way, with a lot of people coming over from Albania, which for all its flaws is not a country where people are actually in peril and they're trying to claim the asylum on the back of that. To my mind, that's a pure abuse of the system. So I think the key point is the state needs to process appeals against rejection of asylum much more efficiently, and then be seen to actually deport people who are actually in breach of, who aren't actually genuine asylum seekers. So that's one thing that could actually relieve part of the issue. The other side of it is, of course, is that there are parties who are looking to exploit what I consider to be people's natural anger about people getting things like medical cards and accommodation ahead of the queue. And the other thing about people talking about Ireland being full, we need only look around the sheer plague of derelict properties, not just anywhere in Ireland, even in Letterkenny for that matter. And you could say to yourself, well, a start is not full, and maybe we need to start looking at an effective way of dealing with the scourge of dereliction as well in the country. But I get completely people's anger and frustration about the lack of provision to free medical care and the lack of housing, because that's something where we're really falling down at the moment, and we need to really do a lot better on that.
We have just some listeners' comments. Yeah, go ahead, Peter.
Can I make one point?
Yes, please.
I think there are different groups of people who are coming into the country. There are refugees from a war-torn country such as Syria and Ukraine. There are people who are coming from countries where they are truly in danger for their lives, and they are true refugees. And then there are a massive number of economic migrants. And that is the problem. It is the economic migrants who swell the numbers, and they are effectively affecting the true refugees and the true people who are asylum seekers, because economic refugees have no real right to the same status as asylum seekers or war-torn refugees.
All right. And I just think if there was more communication, like even more explanation from the government as to where refugees are coming from, why they're coming here. And you know, you've outlined that to a great extent there, Peter. But I just don't understand why decision makers don't understand that in an information vacuum, there's a lot of different elements that are there to fill it, and also people's fears. Because people, Laura, speaking to local Gardaí, there's quite a sizable population in Letterkenny at the moment. Speaking to Gardaí, they've had no issues. They've had no reason. There's been no crime involving any of these people. But people are genuinely concerned for the safety of their children. I get it, like, but I'm not sure how much of it's evidence-based.
Yeah, as you rightly said, we've heard of stories, you know, where there's been busloads of maybe refugees coming in the night, and not even the councillors are aware that maybe this is happening. So there clearly is an information problem there. I think that, you know, it really is, again, comes back to, as I said earlier, consultation. Would it be that hard just to have chat with the local community? And I know what you were saying about, look, there is going to be protests, there's no doubt about that, but I think there has to be an element of a conversation there with the community. Definitely think that's needed.
All right, just some comments here before we move on. Greg, it's racism disguised as concern. No excuse for it. We're a rich country, but our sense of entitlement to keep it for ourselves and not let anyone from outside of Ireland to share it is just pure racism and makes me ashamed to be Irish. The only thing the fearful are worried about is having to share the takings. Hi, Greg. There is 40 mixed nationalities unvetted and have a curfew to check in and out as they go. These are all men. Like, who on God's earth wants this in a small village? Please ask one of your panel to explain what the far right is and what their involvement in these protests is about. It's the government that is making Irish people go against immigrants due to them getting everything under the sun when Irish people have to fight tooth and nail to get everything or anything they're entitled to. Who are these far-right people? If you go out to protest now against anything, you're classed as far-right. This country has become a joke. What about treating everyone the same that needs help? You wouldn't have people out on the street everywhere. There is a with every topic now, and this seems to be the same with this one, of course, there's extreme views in either direction, Peter. I know I don't want to sound like a scratched record, but I tend to, just after I say that, there just seems very little common ground now. I see those who some would call far right and what they come out with, and then I see those who would probably be classed then by the far right as far left and some of the stuff they come out with. And there just seems I don't know where the people in the centre are, but I don't hear them. I hope they're there, or maybe we're just so divided now as a nation, as a people.
I'm afraid all of us have been woked at one stage or another. It is difficult to actually stick your head above the parapet and say anything, because if you mention refugees in a negative way, you're a racist. If you so it's very difficult for, as you say, the middle ground to actually say anything, because you can be pilloried for anything you say, and you will find someone who, if you're someone who is very pro refugees, you'll call them a racist, and vice versa. It's an impossible situation, because anybody who voices an opinion can get crucified for it, and it has effectively stifled conversation. In regard to politicians, I mean, they're all being very careful about what they say, because their constituents and people who vote for them will all have views, so they want to make sure they keep on the right side of everybody. So it's an impossible situation, and it's the woke generation and social media, which means that if you do say something, 10,000 people might have heard it before, 1 million people hear it now.
Yeah, and normally politicians like to sort of maybe wait to see which way the wind's blowing, but very turbulent winds at the moment, blowing in all directions, and maybe that's why we're not seeing, you know, anything really strong policy-wise. Richard, I used to think that maybe the extreme was sort of 10% either way and 80% in the middle. I'm not sure it's like that anymore. I can't get a gauge of it.
I'm very mindful of the last lines in Animal Farm, where pig looked to man and man looked to pig, and none could actually tell the difference. I think there's often a circle, isn't there, between the extreme left and the extreme right, where they actually end up meeting each other. I think the issue is, as I've said earlier on, is that this whole issue of refugees and asylum seekers and all of that has actually laid bare, I think, some of the key challenges that we as a state actually face. And, you know, we've failed, we're attempting, but we've failed so far to provide universal health care to our citizens. And I think that is something that, you know, we need to address. And, you know, we have to understand how we're going to achieve that. We're the only EU country, I believe, that doesn't actually have universal health care. So, you know, that's a sort of, in my mind, a justifiable grievance from the protesters. It's not all black and white as far as I'm concerned. I understand, you know, why people would be angry that somebody walks into the country and gets free healthcare. But the challenge is that we need to, you know, I'm all for welcoming the genuine refugees and genuine asylum seekers, but we're not that efficient at weeding out the ones who actually turn up as economic migrants, and we need to do that in order to basically alleviate the problem.
All right. The council, were chatting to us during the week and elsewhere, of course. They've launched a campaign to ask people to relocate to Donegal to work, saying it's got so much to offer in terms of digital connectivity and what you can do with your evenings and the arts and all that type of stuff. I'm all for it because I think it's a great place to live. I'm going to put the question to the panel, though, as well. Dr. Peter O'Rourke, I'll start with you. Would you recommend people you hold dear to move from Dublin, Dubai, London, Australia, New York to live and work in Donegal?
Yes, well, I mean, I'm here 25 years. I still can't do the accent, but I love Donegal. I mean, when I came here, I was told by the guys who interviewed me, don't worry, there'll be plenty of jobs in Dublin. You won't have to stay up there ever, there forever, mm-hmm. but I'm more than happy to stay here forever. In theory, yes, it is a great idea, but we were talking about infrastructure, hospital, schools, etc. You need a hell of a lot more of those if you're going to increase the population anymore. But the other thing is there isn't property in Donegal for anybody to move to. There isn't enough builders or people in construction to fix the mica problem, which is going to be going on for many, many years, let alone build masses of houses for people to move to. So, yes, in an ideal world, it's a great place to live. I wouldn't certainly move.
But we're not in an ideal... Sorry, I'm asking you the question, not in an ideal world, Peter.
Oh, yes. I would quite happily, if recommend to any of my friends and family to move up here. It's a lovely part of the country, apart from the weather.
Yeah, and also, apart from the fact that you've been on the record a couple of times worrying who's going to look after you if you get sick when you're older.
Fast car.
Okay, just flee the hills when that happens. Okay, I get you. What do you think, Laura? It is great. I would love to see more supports for people maybe being able to get into accommodation, people coming back who can't get car insurance. You know, the stuff. I'm sure there are some supports there. As I say, you know, I couldn't think of a better place to live. What do you think, Laura?
Well, I suppose from a personal point of view, as someone that moved from Kildare to Bourke in Donegal, definitely I would recommend it. There's no doubt that, look, it's such a beautiful county. Even when I'm driving to work in the morning, sometimes I'm still amazed at how beautiful it is. Even in the council's video, you know, they just showed really just how attractive it is to live here. The video mentioned opportunity and flexibility, and there has been a lot of work done on, you know, remote work and hubs. And look, you only have to see Aaron Moore and the work that was done there, which is great. We do have broadband issues, which is another thing that will have to be tackled into the future. As well as Peter mentioned, the housing problem as well. It's grand inviting people up to live here, but do we have the basics for them? Do we have a house for them to live? There's people in this county with their houses crumbling around them with nowhere to go. We have to tackle that chronic shortage of accommodation. I think there's pros and cons, but on the all, it's such a beautiful place, and you have that kind of good work-life balance, and you can go for a walk on the beach in the evenings, and, you know, just the beauty around you, can't beat that.
Yeah, and there's pros and cons in every county as well. I mean, obviously, we do have some unique challenges to some extent, but I presume every county has the pros and cons, and I think sometimes there are different housing markets as well within it. So, you know, there is, you go to an estate agents, there are some property, you know, there's quite a few properties still there available, I suppose.
As well with connectivity as well. Like, obviously we've no rail, no motorway near us. And when I moved up here first, I didn't have a car. In Kildare, you don't really think about it. You know, we're on the commuter belt, so you just hop on a bus. Don't really think about it at all. But when I moved up, I quickly realised then I had to get a car very quickly.
Yeah, we don't have a choice. I mean, that's just clear, isn't it? Yeah. Richard, what do you think?
God's own county. Why wouldn't you? No, I mean, I'm actually, funny enough, and I was just saying in the break to Laura and Peter, I'm actually looking to buy a property now in Inishowen. And it's hopefully by the end of the year, might be relocating part-time up there, because, I mean, the broadband connections, and that's the killer deal for me, is to make sure that I've adequate broadband. I mean, I'm now in a situation where I only have to be in the office 2 days a week. And if you're in this, and also, you know, we still have direct flights down to London from City of Derry Airport. So on the Inishowen side, that would be the airport of choice for us in a way. And even without City of Derry, there's good connections at Belfast International, etc. So for me, heading towards hopefully semi-retirement at this stage, I very much want to try and, you know, use Donegal as a base, because as Laura said, where we are in Inishowen, I mean, is fabulous. It's like Ireland in miniature, and, you know, the walks are fantastic. I think the key thing is longer term, Donegal and the state needs to address the connectivity of Donegal to the rest of Ireland, which is quite frankly pretty poor. And, you know, we're hoping that we'll see some developments over the coming months on that. But that's the only really issue. I mean, the thing is, like you say, Laura, you do need a car to function in Donegal. Although we have a neighbour down the road from us in Quigley's Point. She hasn't got a car, and she just uses the regular bus into Derry in and out, and she gets her groceries delivered. So, you know, it's difficult, but it's doable. And I mean, the fact that you've got the local link bus service now has been, you know, a bit of a game.
I think the problem with a lot of those is just getting you to work at the right time and getting you from work at the right time, and also dependent on how far you have to travel from your home to wherever the bus might be. But we're such a rural county, you're not going to be able to connect all of those dots at any stage. Anyway, another thing too about Donegal, Peter, is that you could pick six or seven spots and have a completely different experience in any of them, couldn't you? It's a very, I'm not sure if it's unique, because I'm not well enough traveled to say to suggest that is the case. But there's an awful lot of diversity within the county in different parts of it as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful county. I think there's more beaches in Donegal than the rest of Ireland put together because of our coastline. And exploring the coastline is fabulous. I mean, you can walk and walk and walk, and it's just wonderful. But in regard to the housing side of things, the only houses, because someone of mine has been looking at houses, the only houses that are for sale in Letterkenny are previously rental properties that landlords are getting out of. There is minimal construction going on in Donegal anywhere, and anything that is one-off housing that people are building themselves. I was talking to someone in construction the other day, and he said there's only something like 12 registered building contractors in Donegal, that's all. And that's why, you know, if they're going to spend the next 20 years fixing mica houses, there ain't going to be any new houses being built, and certainly no significant estates. So, I mean, the potential of finding a house in Dublin is hard, but I'd say in Donegal, they just don't exist.
Richard, you've mentioned a couple of times now about maybe some positivity in terms of connectivity. I mean, I presume you're talking, are you, about Eamon Ryan's comments as it relates to rail. Like, but I know when we talk about that and we talk about a connection in Letterkenny, you know, there's people in Dunloe, Burton Port, where trains used to go to before, Killybegs, yeah. Ardra, Kilcar, Mallon, you know, Carr and Donna, that it still would be very difficult. I'm not being negative here, but it would still be very difficult for them to get to Letterkenny to get a train to spend
with the current
5 hours going
exactly,
to Dublin.
Exactly, Greg. With the current bus services, yes. And I think we need to look at this in a very, very holistic picture. I mean, I'm delighted we're even having this debate now. Who would have thought 20 years ago we'd be actually looking at this as a possibility? But it could happen yet. Now, obviously, if we get a connection from Letterkenny initially to Derry and then hopefully onwards down to Dublin, that does make a big difference for the connectivity to Letterkenny. But there's a wider picture. And whilst I don't think it's practical now at this stage, and big and all as a fan of the railways as I am, to actually build a new line out to Killybegs or to Dunloe or whatever, what we can do is ensure that there's a proper, adequate and frequent bus service. Because, I mean, for instance, where we are in Inishowen, and it's a fairly, you know, populated area, and we're very, very close to Derry. There's only about 4 buses a day into Derry, and that's the same timetable we had 50 years ago when I was a nipper. So, you know, we need to actually look very seriously at rural bus provision, make sure it's adequately connecting, you know, far-flung places, or even just not that far-flung.
But is that going to happen, Richard? Because we are a population at the moment of 160,000-odd, which of course will increase to some extent. It's never going to be financially sustainable. There's going to have to be a subvention, isn't there?
I think. Well, there is, but I think.
I mean, are Dublin going to open the purse strings to run this myriad of buses into every corner of Donegal to take them to Letterkenny for the train? I don't think so.
Well, as under the current models that they've been using up till now, everything on transport is often demand-led. So what we often do in Ireland, and it's unique to Ireland, is we put the transport cart before the horse and we say, we're not going to give you a bus service until you have enough population. But how are you going to have enough population? And I go back to my earlier point about planning. You know, as part of the whole expansion of the railway network, this is not just about adding a train service to Letterkenny and moving on and forgetting about it. This is actually about building up a proper amount of infrastructure so you can actually enable population expansion. Now, if we look at the Ireland 2040 plans that the government have had as policy for some years now, if you're going to expand the population of the state to up to 8 million, you're not going to do that by just chucking everybody into Dublin. You're going to actually have to have a long-term development plan for places like Letterkenny and also places like, you know, along the West Coast in order to encourage people to move in there. And as I said earlier on, there's an inadequate provision of social housing. There's an inadequate, and you know, Peter's pointed out that we haven't even got the building contractors at this stage to build stuff. So we have to take a very, very holistic approach to how we, you know, not we actually use infrastructure as the seed to provide expansion, rather than which is the current, unlike the current state policy, which is basically treating infrastructure like a reward for expansion. You know, you have to actually.
Yeah, we kind of do it at this stage now. Is if they come, we might consider building it rather than it might be the other reverse. Laura, what do you think the prospects of, you know, a rail link into that? Can it be great if it comes to pass? But can you then see the follow through whereby, you know, people from all over the county would be able to rely on a service that might get them there in a timely fashion to make their flight at Dublin Airport or whatever it might be?
Yeah, I think what Eamon Ryan said was that he was a great believer in it. And I think the key word there is believer. I'm really happy that Richard said he's feeling optimistic about the outcome of the rail review. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that. It would be brilliant. But Eamon Ryan said in the Dáil a few weeks ago, you know, while a link between Letterkenny and Derry and Durban, Omagh and Dungannon would be big benefit to the island, it would be hugely expensive. And that much of that, the cost of that line would fall to the UK government. So, look, we've seen the problems with the A5, how long that has taken. You know, it's been in the pipeline for so many years and still no diggers on site. So it would be brilliant to see rail return to Donegal, but I think it's at best an aspirational.
Yeah, you see, the thing is because we kind of have evidence of this at the moment. Say I'm in Donegal town, right? I can drive to Dublin in less than 3 hours. Okay, there is the option to go 45 minutes to Sligo, hop in a train, get into Dublin. But if I want to go to the airport, what do I do then? Or if I want to go to other parts of Dublin, how do I, you know, you get in your car and you fly past Sligo. Is that just what's going to happen, Richard, with a railway into Letterkenny? Is it going to be a white elephant, really? Is it going to be used?
I think it will be used. And experience shows, and I work in the rail industry in the UK, where you've actually got provision, people will use it. And the projections that a lot of the transport bodies and the government departments often have made on these schemes is way too conservative. I'll give you two examples. Crossrail, or the Elizabeth Line as it's now branded in London, which is the big shiny new railway linking East and West London together in the mainline railway. The Department of Transport over here, their projections were around about 50% of the actual numbers using it. In Scotland, similar situation to Letterkenny, where you had the closed railway between Edinburgh and Tweedbank, and Tweedbank would be a similar population size to Letterkenny. The UK National Department of Transport originally forecast that the numbers would be so small that it wasn't worth doing. In fact, the Scottish government then decided on their own bat to fund it. And they discovered that the numbers went about five times over their projections. The Derry line, the existing Derry line between Derry and Belfast, the Northern Ireland Department of Infrastructure forecast that there was never going to be any demand to have more than a couple of trains a day, and that was it. In fact, when they brought the new trains in and then brought in a clock-faced timetable, people have flocked to it, and the numbers have exceeded the very conservative predictions that the civil servants and the so-called experts in the Department of Transport have actually said there's going to be. So it is a bit like Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. And, you know, certainly for somewhere like Donegal, where the most practical option for most of us in Donegal to get to Dublin is simply to get in the car and drive. I mean, you know, you need a transport option which would actually get people out of their cars. And quite frankly, buses, you know, long distance buses, and I've done that long distance bus myself so many times, you know, it doesn't cut it for most people.
Okay, well, let's be hopeful. But I mean, Peter, do you envisage me and you bumping into each other on the train as it pulls out of Letterkenny?
No. I mean, it's a lovely idea, and if the train system that was there in the 50s was still there, it would be great if people use it. But providing a train from Letterkenny to Derry, Derry to Belfast, Belfast to Dublin, is going to take so long and cost so much that people aren't going to get out of the cars. If you have a family of four travelling down to Dublin and you can do it for €80 return in fuel, you're not going to spend €150 on a journey that takes twice the length of time, and you arrive in Dublin with no transport to get around and having to get taxis and buses around there. So realistically, I can't see it happening. I mean, our biggest problem in Donegal is that we have a transport minister who lives in Dublin and cycles to work. If he was cycling from Letterkenny down to the Dáil once a week with his Garda cyclists behind him, I'm sure he'd realise that there is other places outside Dublin. You know, cycling 4 or 5 kilometres in Dublin to get to work in the morning is not the same as the way it is travelling around Ireland. And unfortunately, the main focus of our transport minister is to stop motorways being built where other people can use them because he doesn't need to.
Yeah, and I mean, even in the county's biggest town, Laura, you would feel you're taking your life in your hands cycling anywhere because of the ad hoc cycle lanes, there's drains in them, they're up and down off the pavement, they disappear at places. Do you know what I mean? Like, we've a long way to go on that issue as well.
Yeah, and I was just driving yesterday, and the amount of, I think the state of the roads at the moment is really bad, just with potholes and things. So it's just, yeah, it's crazy. You won't be taking your life in your hands.
Quick break, back with more in a sec. Taoiseach Micheál Martin signalled support for the decriminalisation of drugs, saying he'll back calls from his own TDs for a health-led approach. Would you agree with decriminalising all drugs, Peter O'Rourke?
I think, yes, I think the use of drugs should be decriminalised because they're not the problem. The problem are the suppliers. So if you can take the drugs out of the system, then it ceases to be a problem. I think they're actually decriminalising in some Canadian province, I think it is, they're decriminalising all, even grade or level one drugs. I think punishing the people who use the drugs, as would have happened in the 60s and 70s, for smoking a joint, you could get 6 months, is not a solution to the problem. I think it's cut the supply and cut the head off all the organisations that supply drugs, and rather than victimise the people who unfortunately use them. Because that's not going to solve the problem.
Does it send a message out, though, that drugs aren't as bad as maybe you were being told and people might be more inclined to dabble?
I think people will dabble anyway. I mean, it's inconceivable for us to consider why someone would start snorting heroin or injecting themselves with heroin or crystal meth or anything like that. It's inconceivable to us that someone would actually do that, because they know what we know what it leads to, but people still do it. I don't think anything by decriminalising it will make it more attractive.
Okay. Laura McMonagall, editor of the Donegal News newspaper, what say you?
Well, I know that the two TDs that were proposing this said, you know, treat people with drug addictions with a justice response is not appropriate. And I think we can see that even in the court system. Like, you know, people are appearing before the courts for, say, like €5 worth of a substance, and you just have to question whether is that a good use of Garda resources and the court service time. I definitely think there is scope for, you know, reform of drug policy. I think legalising drugs probably will not stop the illegal drug trade. You know, it's a hugely lucrative business for criminals, and those criminals aren't going to just like shut up shop and stop. But I thought it was strange when I heard it on the radio yesterday.
Yeah, because, I mean, like, say, for instance, I mean, obviously the government's trying to price people out of smoking for very good reason, but there's a massive trade in illegal cigarettes off the back of Ilari cigarettes. It's absolutely massive. Right, okay, so you're on the fence. You're shocked. Suck it and see. Let's see what happens, Laura. See, my position on this is I actually don't really know what the right thing to do is. You know, I'm not a drug user. I'm not someone who works with drugs. I know I wouldn't, because, you know, I just so it doesn't affect me. So I don't really can't formulate opinion on it, because I don't want to, I would be misguided, really. So that's why I'm asking people like Richard Logue.
So I think, well, my position, it's kind of on the fence to an extent. I think certain drugs, so cannabis, for instance, I think should be definitely legalized, but it should also, the sales should be controlled in the same way that tobacco and alcohol's sales are controlled. Because if you start to control the sale and actually set minimum standards of quality, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, when we talk about drug abuse, we've got a far bigger problem in all of these countries with alcohol abuse and deaths from tobacco related illnesses and all of that. And yet they're legal substances. Now, there is a big issue with the illegal sale of cigarettes, and they've taken several moves over the years to try and regularise those. I would have a problem with the hard drugs, so the heroines, the crack cocaines, etc., and all that sort of thing. But I don't believe criminalising the user is ever the answer. The real threat in our society is the supply chains for these items. So my view is this: legalise cannabis, but control it, in the same way that alcohol and tobacco are controlled. But then in terms of the hard drugs, considering the amount of damage those substances use, but I don't believe ever criminalising the user. It's really about the supply chains is the big problem.
Yeah, but it's kind of strange even now, like, that we could all, if we wanted to, get together and go into a building in Letterkenny or Dunloe or somewhere and all start drinking this potion that makes us all go wired in the head and fall around laughing. I mean, that's legal. It's crazy when you think about it, Peter, isn't it? And then the ED has to pick up the pieces. Like, you know, we're talking about, oh, cannabis, this kind of... We can all go in and we all get start singing and fighting and falling around the place. It's all perfectly
legal. Sounds like a lot of fun.
No, I know it does, but it's like, when you know, when you think about it, it's mind-altering drugs that's perfectly acceptable. We have a reputation for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, also, but you have to remember historically what happened when Prohibition was brought in America. They banned alcohol, as a result of which crime syndicates developed and flourished. Mm. So, you know, you ban something and you have a similar situation with the drug trade in the world, because it's banned, it becomes criminalized, and criminals make billions doing it, as they did in Prohibition in the States. So, you know, there isn't an answer to these questions. It's trying to get a mid-line, mid-ground that everybody can live with.
Dr. Peter O'Rourke, former consultant orthopedic surgeon, thank you. Lovely to have you on the programme. Laura, thank you so much for joining us. It was great to have you on. Have a great day and weekend, long weekend. That's Laura McMonagall, who is the editor of the Donegal News newspaper. And finally, but not least, of course, Richard Logue, project manager in transport in London. Looking forward to getting home at least for 5 days a week to beautiful Inishowen. Richard, thank you very much indeed. Great to have you on the show. Really good to have you on. All right.